Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 7th, 2005, and today's session is a forum, Holden Households, facilitated by Ingrid Chris Johnson with Bonnie Miller McLemore. This is disc number FO-2005-20. Let's listen in.
Welcome to a regular classic Holden Village Forum. What makes it regular and classic is, one, it's a topic that we all have feelings and opinions and experience about and with, and it's something that we care about and something that we think we probably know quite a lot about. A forum is a place where people at Holden can come together and share their experience, and share their wisdom, and share their knowledge in ways that are both respectful and passionate. So it's great to contend things, and it's great to have someone else contend something different. It's not great, of course, to shut anybody down or up or any other direction. So we try to welcome and attend to carefully all points of view, partly because the gift that Holden brings to us all is that we all bring our best heads and hearts into the circle. And we share our thinking and our feeling in ways that is bound to produce something good, because people here are good. So I welcome you all to this Holden Forum, where we can talk about households, families, households of God, oikonomia. We have a wonderful panel here of experts. And what I would say about the panel is the same thing I would say about everybody in the room. The notion of a forum at Holden is that everybody talks and everybody can talk, and it's a place where we're all experts. So, if everybody is an example of a kind of family, then all of us, all individuals here and throughout the village, can bring their own experience of family to bear. And we represent various forms the household of God takes. So we're going to hear a few stories of family from people in the panel, and then Bonnie is going to reflect from a theological point of view about family, from a biblical point of view. The hope is that we will deepen and stretch our notion of what family is. And the panelists here are Peg Haug, who is sitting right there, and who is living in the village. Mm-hmm. And Melanie Wallendorf, who's sitting right here, and who is living in the village for a week or two. Steve Rigo, who's here for how long? 2 weeks or something?
1 week.
1 week.
2 more days.
Janet Grant, who's here for 11 years. So that's another length of time.
And Linnea.
And Linnea, my daughter.
And Linnea, who's here for a month. And I may choose to say some things too, and I'm here for a couple weeks. Did I leave anyone out?
No.
No? Bonnie, it's Bonnie at the end. Okay. Bonnie McLemore, who's going to say some theological or biblical reflections about family after the stories that we go through here. So Peg, do you mind starting?
Do I?
Well, you don't have to if you don't want.
I have no notes here.
Okay, that's good. I asked everyone to tell one story about their own family. So that's what you'll be hearing.
So you're not going to get one story from me. I figured I'd just need to tell you a little bit about what my family is. I was married, had 3 kids, got a divorce. 6 years later, I met my partner, Juanita. And we've been in a relationship for 15 years now. My children were 9, 13, and 14 at the time, living with their dad, spending the summers with me and holidays and going back and forth. For many years, we had been in that pattern. So, and that interesting, because I was just asking Juanita, that first summer we came up to Holden, and we said we were a family. It was like one of the first times. I mean, we had been together for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And somebody in registration didn't quite know what kind of family that was. And I kept saying, but our checkbook, we have both names on the checkbook.
Does and, that do it?
Right. It helps. And, you know, Deanne was here. Deanne Lapraquist was here. And she overheard the conversation. And we went to our room, and she came back. She went and found us and kind of apologized and explained and said that it was a young man, and he just didn't quite know what we were talking about and what we were referring to. But we considered ourselves a family at that point. But that did not make us a family. I think what made us a family was years of struggle and years of building relationships, because families don't just happen. But at this point, we all, I think if you asked any one of us individually, we would say we feel like a family. And I was trying to think, what is it that has made us feel like a family? And of course, it's the celebrations. It's the holidays, spending time, all of us get together when we can. My children are now 24, my son, and my two daughters are 28 and 29. Both girls are single moms, and the boys are, I mean, talk about a blended family. Both of the boys, our dads are black, so the boys are mixed. And in fact, they were just up here a month ago. And again, they came up to see, because it's family time. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get my son up here. But it's birthdays, we travel around, and when we're in the Seattle area working for a while, we often will have all of the kids over and the grandkids where we're staying. We live in an RV, and we park at a friend's house. So it's those times together. It's looking back and realizing that my kids will call Juanita for about certain problems, and they'll come to me about other problems. I think, like in any family, you know, you talk to dad sometimes, and you talk to mom about other things. On Mother's Day, I don't even get a card usually from my son, but my daughters send cards, and they'll give a card to Juanita too. I think the best place where you really see the blending is with the grandsons, who are 6 and 7 right now. And I'm grandma, and Juanita is Grandma Nita. And so there's two names, right. And Trey, who's 7 now, when he was about 4 or 5, and maybe even to 6, every time he'd visit, he'd kind of try to figure out. We didn't spell anything out who we were. They knew that we shared a home together. They knew that when you went and saw the grandmas, you saw two grandmas. But once in a while, he'd ask Juanita if she was a he. Even though he knew her name and he knew who she was, he was trying to make her fit this mold. We haven't really spelled anything out or explained anything to him. In the same way, even with my three kids, the girls were older. You know, they were 13 and 14, and I had some intense conversations with them when I came out as a lesbian, and they, going through their own adolescence at that point, I mean, that was hard for them, and they were trying to understand me. My son was 8 or 9, and we didn't really talk about it, he just kind of knew. And finally, when he was 15, I showed him that movie by Margaret Kammermeier.
Oh, yeah.
Does anybody remember that movie?
the military gal.
Yes, yeah. Yes, with her four sons.
Can you remember the name of it?
No, but she they
serving in something in silence. No.
They figured serving out that she
serving in silence.
Serving in silence. Yes. Uh-huh. And then I finally had a conversation with him, and he's kind of like, yeah, he knew, you know, and it was okay. And I think it was more to reassure me that he knew I loved him, and it was really fine with him. But again, it was the age. So I don't want to talk too much more. I couldn't think of just one point where, or one story where we all realize we're family. But when I look back on it now, or when we experience what we are now, it's those relationships that we've struggled to build. And I think because we all love each other. My kids love me. They know I love Juanita. And this is not to say they haven't had their struggles with her, but they've all come to love her in their own way, I think. And it goes without question that she cares about them. Thanks.
You're next.
Okay. My life story in a nutshell. I'm a college professor, so I have my notes in front of me just to make me feel like I'm doing things. And if you need to write a letter to anybody, I'll be happy to have you writing while I'm talking, because then I'll feel like you're taking notes. You should do it. You don't have to. You're now going to hear a late middle-aged woman explain her age and be proud of it. Because I think that's an important part of this story. I'm 52, and I have a 10-year-old daughter who was just here. After years of infertility treatment that led to disappointment after disappointment, finally, and this was a process of years and years and years, finally, one day, there was a very happy phone call from our adoption social worker who said, "Congratulations, you have a baby girl." And I was 42 at the time. And had spent much of my adult life getting various college degrees, getting a job as a professor, getting tenure, getting promoted to full professor, doing all of that. And that pretty much was the focus of my life, because it was not an easy thing to accomplish that at that time. So, finally, when I was 42, I became a mother in a phone call. And, you know, people would say, "Well, were you ready?" Well, yes, I was ready. No, I wasn't ready.
Who's ready for a kid?
When Linnea was 5, I was divorced from her adopted father. His job is in international development, and so much of her life he had been away for long periods of time, and then home, and then away for long periods of time and home. And so he had been intermittently in our household. She still sees him. He lives abroad, and he periodically comes back to Tucson, where we live, and sees her there. So she does have contact with him. But now, the two of us are a family. I am sometimes asked now if she is my granddaughter or if she's my daughter.
Yeah.
That wasn't so much true 10 years ago, but as time goes on and I am getting older, I get asked that question, and I'm quite happy to say she's my daughter. We are a family, even though there are only two of us. And I realized that you had asked me, Ingrid, you know, what are some moments when you feel like that family is really functioning. At exactly the moment today when the announcement was made about the bombings in London, Linnea, who had been outside, came in, and she had in her hand half of a robin's eggshell. And she was just glowing with the happiness and joy of new life and all that that eggshell represented. And it was so clear to me that there's the world out there, and there's the world of our family, and they are often going in completely different directions. And, you know, I didn't interrupt her moment by saying, no, you know, we can't be that way right now because, you know, we've learned of this tragedy, just as we learn every day of the tragedy of Israelis dying and Palestinians dying and people in Iraq and Iran and all over the place. We have days when 30, 40 people die. And so in that moment, we just had this delightful little family time of enjoying that Robin's egg. And it's up in our room right now. And now it takes on a whole lot more meaning to me about how family is an encapsulated experience that exists within the larger world, but also exists apart from it.
Thank you. Steve.
Steve, okay. Brenda is over here, my wife. We were both divorced around 1992, and by chance met each other as our lives were kind of in shambles. And a lot of woundedness from both of our previous marriages. In my previous marriage, I had two children, and then in that turmoil, there was a third one that I brought to the party with Bretta. So I carefully say this because
I wasn't the mom.
Right.
It sounded like me.
Sorry. Children are not baggage, but my kids, I have these three children that had a lot of baggage, so, and then of course I had my own baggage, so to use the baggage metaphor. And Bretta has one daughter, that's the one that's with us all the time, Brittany. Three of our kids are here now. The eldest is in the middle of her college program and not here this summer. I'll tell you three little vignettes, very short. And before I do that, I wanted just three tiny little things that have helped us a lot in this fairly common kind of divorce and blended family, if you can say that. We've always stared down and defied the stereotypes. People will come, and it's usually more the other moms will come to Bretta and say, well, you must have just a hell of a time with all the, you know, how the war stories about blended family moms or whatnot. She seems to get more of that. No? But we kind of always stand up to that. And, well, it's, you know, no. And you, of course, want to be polite, but it hasn't been our reality, and we don't like the stereotype. The language of the whole blended family thing, too, is very important. We feel that, and we don't even talk in terms of blended family too much, but one example of language, I guess, would be that step this and step that, and we just don't do it. And I think it's, you know, a lot of people don't. You still hear it, and then the people around you sometimes try to, and we always make sure we kind of try to model it, you don't. And I think it's important, and eventually people kind of get used to that. A lot of people already are. One story is Christmas Eve. I think we were together only about a year or two at that point, and our eldest, her name is Leave, and Leave was very sick, throwing up Christmas Eve. And Christmas Eve is the whole banana, kind of. Christmas Day is a little bit of an afterglow or afterthought. And she had a big metal pot she was just vomiting in off and on all, and she wanted to kind of be a part of it, but she was way over there. We kind of were trying to have our Christmas Eve dinner, and Bretta was, and Leap was the one, because she was old enough to remember more of me with her mom, and Bretta probably seemed a little more of a intruder to her, and maybe 8 or 9 at that point. And Lee was the one that was having the hardest time with all that. But Bretta just kind of was with her through that whole evening of vomit. And I, you, And to me, maybe I'm wrong, and I'm not even sure Lee would be conscious of it, but that was a turning point for her. And from then on, she knew, well, this person cares about me. And Christmas Eve, and we still kind of joke about that Christmas. Remember that Christmas Eve when we were throwing up the whole night? And, well, anyway, I'll go to a story about Nils. Is a little simpler. He's the tallest guy running around. And it was kind of funny. We were across the street. There's a museum with the big grounds. And we were throwing the ball, I think, and he was running around and took a pretty bad spill and skinned it, you know, a lot of blood, looked pretty visually, it wasn't so bad in reality. And I was there, and he went running to Bretta. You remember this? And it was, I just kind of went, whoa, that's big stuff. And I was ready for him to run to me, but it was good. I think little moments like that that you can't put in your day book and plan. That's probably good enough.
And apparently,
yeah.
We do
play those. Janet.
We'll try.
I'm Janet. Janet Grant. I am an always single person that has not birthed children. Roseanne was telling me today of someone else she knows who says, happily single most of the time. That's probably me as well. I have a story about. Several years ago, I was walking out in the miner's village with someone who I didn't know very well, and we were getting to know each other. And she said, well, do you have family? And I was like, well, yeah. and I knew what she meant is, do you have children? And so it was a very awkward moment, you know, but I screwed up my courage to be confident. And I said, yes, I have parents, and I'm the youngest of four children, and I have lots of nieces and nephews who I care about deeply. So, I mean, it create the family as a buzzword, creates a lot of awkward moments for me. I deeply feel familial, but I don't have children of my own. But I've kind of tried over the years. I'm the youngest of four, and there's quite a distance in age from my siblings and myself. So I have nieces and nephews who are I was an aunt when I was 10. And so now as an adult, they're all adults and we're friends. And I'm knitting a scarf for each one. This is for Christmas and their spouses. They will all be married by the time Christmas comes around. And I will have my 18th grandniece or nephew in October. So, part of what I try to do is keep up with all of those people. That means a lot of postage, a lot of cards from this place. And I also try to create family. This place has allowed me to create family very well. And I wouldn't be able to be here probably if I were not single. I don't think my personality would be such that I would have been here these many years. So part of what I've done here is I have, over the 11 years that I've lived here, have had 5 different boarding students live with me, all of them ranging in age from 7th grade to 12th grade. And having them live with me and, you know, putting up with the teenager kinds of things that many people do, but of course the teenagers that come here are pretty wonderful and not a problem. I find ways to have children in my life, and it's not that I work at it so hard, it's just that there are children around me that I like, and I get to know them and try to build relationships with them. One of the hard things for me over the years has been is knowing those boundaries for them, to not cross a boundary that they have established or are trying to establish, because I like children and I want to be in a relationship, but I also don't want to push them to a place that's uncomfortable for them. So it takes work and sensitivity to who they are. So I have been in my family of origin the one for many, many years who has been the connector person. I'm the one that made the family game for Christmas one year, kind of thing. So that helps. That's kind of my personality and what I care about. But I consider myself to be a very good aunt. I know how to be an aunt.
That's great.
And
I love it.
And I'm aunt to lots of people in my blood family, but I'm also aunt to many young people, young adults, some of them now, and littler people, even though they might not call me aunt, but I feel that's my relationship and that I know how to do that.
I'm going to tell you a quick story about my family. I'm married. I've been married for 31 years, and we lived together for 5 years before that, and as we said, we shared money and we shared responsibilities for each other's families. During the years prior to that, my husband's father was elderly and we cared for him. So I guess that means 36 years that we felt dedicated both to God and to one another. We have two children. We have also made it a point, living in Chicago, to have an extended family of chosen friends, chosen family. We had political friends from 35 years ago doing anti-war work, doing anti-racism work, and doing work in the women's movement that have remained our friends all this time. I had a women's group that's now 30-some years old. I don't know how old it is, but it's old. In my women's group, we all had children the same ages, either adopted or born. And so those children of my little women's group have been like siblings to my two children. And the way that I really was impressed with that is the fact that about a year ago, 2 years ago, one of the women in the women's group, Phyllis, was diagnosed with cancer. And during, she died. And during the 6 months or so of her path to death, she asked me to particularly accompany her. So I was there. She died at home and she lived, you know, as she got sicker and sicker, she was at home. So I was there much every day for the last 3 months. But the remarkable and stunning thing was that the kids were there. And the kids, you know, all in their 20s, none of the kids in the children of the women's group, none of them hang out together so much anymore. But they come together for special occasions, they come together for birthdays, they make a point of seeking each other out for certain occasions. But my telephone would ring at 3 a.m. and it would be my daughter saying, Phyllis has just gone to the hospital, I'm taking my sleeping bag and going out to stay with Sarah. You know, so the kids who had grown up since they were newborns with this cluster of children all just stood up to the challenge and came through for each other. And I think death is scary, and I think watching someone die is scary, but they didn't miss a beat. They were there. Marcus was there, Katie was there, all the other kids in that little group, although they really don't hang out together so much anymore as people in their 20s, accompanied Phyllis's children through and beyond the end. And somehow to me that, I felt like family in a new way, seeing how terrific those kids were. I'm so grateful that I have a husband that I love and who loves me, and that we can look at our old age and try to let our children take flight and not depend on them too much to be around, although happily, they're both still in Chicago, and we're crazy about both of them. One of them is living at Holden now for 6 months, and he, you know, wants to spend more and more time here, I think, in a way. He's really very happy here, but the family has been a gift, the immediate family, but it's been strengthened by the community of family. And I think that is probably what I would want to say about that, is how much stronger my personal family is because we're in a community of people. Now we're going to turn to Bonnie for some biblical images.
I'm going to do a couple things.
Okay.
Just in listening. I'm actually trained in both psychology and religion. My degree was in religion, but it was a degree in religion and psychology at the time from the University of Chicago. And just in listening, I think it'd be interesting to just give a quick psychological portrait of what I think is happening with family change, and then some biblical stuff that might be fruitful just to spark some of your thoughts and conversation. In listening, I was struck by the ways in which psychologically people grasp four categories, which often then can become stereotypes. And I was thinking back of a book I read years ago called Frogs, Snails, and Feminist Tales. Wonderful study of sparked by the author is a woman, I can't remember her name now, but by the dissonance that she saw children experience when feminist fairy tales were read to them, just their resistance. And she was curious about this, and I can't remember the details of her argument or much of her thesis, but one piece of her thesis was that young children are grasping for clear and dichotomous distinctions. So you are either this or that. And so in a certain age range, to disturb that is very disturbing to their categorizations. It strikes me that developmentally, our society is sort of at the elementary school age. We are, and in fact, another psychological text that might be of interest is Robert Keegan. He has a book called In Over Our Heads. And again, I can't remember the details of his thesis, but one piece that would be relevant here is his argument that developmentally, our society expects such amazing feats for us rationally that we cannot keep up with it. We're developmentally challenged. And it strikes me that, I just as I listen, how often you are met with questions like the grandfather, grandmother, are you grandmother, are you mother? The war stories, the assumption, okay, you're in a blended family, it must be a war. And those are people just, they gravitate to, and the do you have a family? I think in each case there were these sort of people grappling to categorize and being frustrated that the one known category, again, I think it's sort of a social developmental stage of the society. We can't quite get to adolescence and adulthood on this family issue, and you know, but maybe we're trying. And so that I thought would be helpful, just to give a psychological lens to sort of this struggle as we deal with the complexity of the way we're changing families. Theologically, I think it'd be nice to just put a biblical picture into this discussion too. And it does move a little bit into theology, but it's helpful just to think biblically. And maybe the truism over against the conservative right that gets said is that there is no Christian, biblical Christian family. And I think, even though that's maybe a truism that the left will say to the right, I think it's fundamentally accurate to the scriptures. The New Testament scriptures are incredibly complex on the issue of family. And you can find about anything you want there to support about any position you want in terms of the so-called family values, arguments, and debates. And I think what I would really want to underscore is instead of simplifying the scriptural tradition, we continue to say that it is rich and even hard for us to understand and interpret, that there's much there upon which we can draw nonetheless. So there are passages in all three synoptic gospels that are radically undermining of the family. They are, and there are two sorts, and they're all in Jesus stories. One sort is where Jesus basically just tells his mother and brothers to get lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are my mother and brothers. These folks in my room who do the will of God, I think is the phrase that he uses. The second troubling passages for family are when he says that he came to set up and divide, put into conflict father and son, mother. You know, he goes through all the varieties of family relationships. And in some ways, I think the Christian tradition is, I wish the rabbi were here to maybe disconfirm this, but is distinct from the Jewish tradition in that it did move gradually, not immediately, the practice of the tradition, the rituals of the tradition, out of the household. For the first two or three centuries, there were household churches with families, obviously, comprising the practice. But gradually, the church moved itself to a separate institution of a reconstituted household. So you have Paul and Pauline language about the household of God. So there are some ways in which Christianity has had a deep ambivalence about the family that has a lot of sources, a couple of which I just mentioned. However, at the very same time, these passages where Jesus has challenged the family, one of the things that's hard for us to get back into the early centuries, that era, and understand what he was doing, is in some of the passages, and Rabbi Mark's pointed this out in the Hebrew text, the word for family, translated in Hebrew, in the text he was using, really translated as household. And that would be largely true also. I don't know Greek. It would be fun to look at a Greek New Testament and see when Jesus rejects family in these ways, what the actual Greek word is for what he's saying. But he was perhaps less undermining what we think of as family in terms of, you know, two parents and children, and more the extended clan system of that time, which included a household of extended family and slaves, and the authority that clan sort of wielded in that era over your life, determining where you went, who you married, and I think he was actually challenging that kind of pervasive and sometimes oppressive authority of the extended clan system more than overthrowing family relationships. Right next to some of these scriptures, you have a variety of ways in which he lifts up family relationships, not a certain family type. I mean, when people look towards a certain family form, that's not what's happening, but he blesses the wedding wine. He breaks bread around family tables. He heals children. He lifts up as models of God's love the caring mother, the caring father. I mean, those are the stories he tells. And I think perhaps, I meant to look this up, one of the most, I think, touching family portraits that you get is the one, I forget which gospel it's in, I think it's in John, when he's on the cross, some pastors could help me, and he reconstitutes a family bond to his disciple, and says, you are the mother, I'm forgetting exactly the words, and you are the son.
Hold your, here, woman behold your son behold your mother.
I think it's a powerful moment, and I guess the message that I heard this some as we talked, some of the theological themes that I heard come out was what I think is even happening in that moment. He is lifting up the importance of family. But he's also saying it can be reconstituted in ever more complex and beautiful ways.
And so at that point, he was handing his mother off to one of his pals.
Yeah. He was basically saying, I'm not going to be here, but you are going to carry forth the relationship that we have had. This makes me want to go back and study that passage more and find out why did that gospel writer feel compelled to tell that story. But it is quite a moving one. And as I listened to how we understand families as you spoke, the theological pieces I heard were that families are places of struggle and suffering, and loving relationship. And sometimes we truncate that word love and think, oh, isn't that sweet and romantic? And no, it's a lot of awfully darn hard work and a lot of pain. And the highest moments may be around loss and suffering. I mean, that did carry through in many of your own stories. And I guess so that was one sort of theological piece I thought you were saying beyond just the biblical. And I think that a second one was really, again, back to the Jesus on the cross story, was the deepening and extension of family love beyond whatever immediate family we all have known and been a part of, which is actually a deep Christian mandate. That yes, indeed, we love those most intimate to us, but in some ways we're commanded to generalize that to others. And that may be one of the biggest challenges. And perhaps one of the biggest ways we can critique the very narrow definition of family values in that discussion, which sometimes forgets that piece, that it's not just about family loyalty, which is indeed important, and family commitment, which is indeed important, but that within family loyalty and family commitment, we're commanded actually to extend that kind of love beyond the family. And again, I heard that theme all the way through, maybe even most powerfully with Janet. There's a phrase, my last comment would be, there's a nice phrase in the African American community, which the African-American community has somewhat avoided the sort of, and they've also been punished for it, but they've avoided sort of the European-American narrowness of family, sometimes out of no choice as a result of slavery. But they have an ethic and a theology of what's, Patricia Hill Collins, she's a black feminist writer, calls, and I don't think she made this term up. I think she's inherited and written and perpetuated it. But it's a phrase called other mothering. And in an African American community, that would be so celebrated. You know, what you're doing is the epitome of mothering. It is to be strived for. The most esteemed women in African American congregations are the other mothers. Not that they denigrate biological mothering, it's a further extension of it. And again, it's something I think we've just let go of. We have glimmers of it in theologies of adoption, our baptismal, but we sort of forget this is a serious, you know, this is a worthy job. So that's, you know, just a few things I heard you all say, too.
Thank you, Bonnie. Great. Well, now it's your turn. Comments, questions, stories, agreements, disagreements.
I was wondering if all of these things are kind of like a trauma time. It sounded like one of them was just a growing, yours maybe, but we had a trauma at our house, and it was when Winfield was 6 months old. In the middle of a nap, he went into convulsions, and no one knew why. So Bruce went in, he's an older brother, he went in and he saw him in there in bed in this convulsion. He'd never seen one before and didn't know what it was. And let's see, he must have been about, 12? Just 12. And Laura was six or seven. Anyway, and the 6-month-old. So our kids are really far apart. And he came out into the kitchen. He said, Mom, I think there's something wrong with Winfield. And I said, is he waking up? And he said, I don't know. And so I went back and looked at him. He was just completely in convulsions. So I rushed to the phone. And well, he went to the phone and called you at the college. And I said, okay, we have to go to the doctor and we have to
get him to the doctor right away, really fast. And so Bill rushed home, and we went down to the hospital, and the pediatrician met us and said, he said, come to the office. So we walked in the office with him still in this huge convulsion. And they took him, he ran with him across the street into the hospital and did a blood test, and they put him on phenobarbital to stop the convulsion. And they still don't know what it was. They did a stool test and discovered there was still some oral polio in there after a month. It was still, but they said that wasn't too different. And then they said, anyway, he was in the hospital for 2 weeks and he was blind. And so we went through this whole thing of, you know, are we going to have a blind child to raise? And the whole family was so affected, and the doctor actually hinted that one of the children, Bruce or Laura, might have given him something that would cause him to have convulsions. And I almost died inside, because I knew they wouldn't do that. Bruce just adored it when Laura was born, and then both of them just loved it when he was born. And so we went through this traumatic time for 2 weeks. And then we had a couple of Episcopal priests come over, and one of them did laying on of hands and restored his sight. And so we took him home, and he was still kind of a weak little baby for a while. And it took quite a while for him to catch up speech-wise. He was just starting to copy sounds, and he didn't do that for a while. And I thought that it stopped him a little bit. But, and his eyes are still weak, but he sees fine. And I just think it really made all the difference in our family. Everybody, my parents and my sister and brother and their families, and I mean, we were shook to the core, because we thought we were going to lose him. And it was... And then, of course, this little miracle that occurred with the Episcopal priest, that made it even better.
So you, having a traumatic experience with a beloved baby in a family is different from doing it without a family.
Yeah.
Another story.
Well, I've never liked going to women's retreats. You go to women's retreats, and very often part of it is sitting quietly in a corner, and everybody's going to share a story. And everybody tells an awful story that they've gone through. And I'm sitting there and thinking what awful thing has happened to me. And I never can find an awful story to tell. It's really quite embarrassing.
Isn't that wonderful?
So I feel like that same thing when I'm sitting here talking about wonderful stories of families, which include trauma.
Yeah.
And I just have, Dwayne and I have been so blessed, my gosh. These Scandinavian hardworking parents and wonderful parents that care about education, and we've got wonderful kids. I mean, it's really embarrassing how fortunate we are. It's just wonderful. But I'm hearing all of your descriptions, and really, to me, it's quite simple. A family are the people you care about more than anybody else in this whole world. Your story of your daughter running in with her eyes shining.
Yep.
Dwayne and I last summer were up here for our 50th anniversary. All our kids, all our grandkids, everybody was here. We had a celebration, and it was wonderful. This year, everybody's in a different direction, so it's just Dwayne and I. Until today, our granddaughter, who just graduated from college, had completed some other training, and she's up here now for a week. Whose eyes were shining for me today when Dwayne and I met that beautiful young lady coming off the bus? I saw a lot of cute people running around here. None of them are as cute as my granddaughter. That's family. That's loving. And it's just, we're all blessed. Your stories are blessing. And blessings like Dwayne and I, we're so fortunate that we've got all these wonderful stories. But nobody cares as much about you as your family and your feelings.
Yeah, what's that Robert Frost line about home is the place where when you've got to go there, they've got to take you? I think it's in The Hired Man.
Yeah. Or even they want to take you. That's right.
Who else has a family comment or question or story or something they want to share?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I found it interesting that everybody talked about children. Even Janet talked about nephews, nieces. But Janet was the only one who talked about having parents and the idea of family as younger people that we include is very prevalent, but to think about our own parents and our own families of origin, I think, is not quite as common. And I'm not sure if that's something that has changed. I would guess it has changed as our demographics have shifted and families have scattered geographically from each other. Mm-hmm. So just a comment.
I just wanted to make one biblical reflection on the Jesus saying his definition of family when his mom and his brothers and sisters come to get him, and he says, "Who are my brothers? Those who do the will of my Father." And I'm not at all disagreeing with your definition, and that's what I heard from up here too. The word love came up all over the place. I'm just curious, Jesus' definition is, Jesus did say, the family is those who I love the most. He says it's those who do the will of my Father in heaven, or whatever his line is there. It's a different definition of family.
Why? It sounds like the giving and the receiving of love to me.
Well, he could have said that. If Jesus wanted to say family are those who you love.
That's how you do the will of the Father, isn't it? To give and receive love.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to argue with that.
No, you can't.
Yeah, I was just... No!
Well, you're right.
Why could it not be both and? Why does it have to be mutually exclusive?
I'm not saying it is mutually exclusive. I'm just pointing out exactly what Jesus said.
Yeah.
He didn't say that. He didn't say, those who I love, those who love me, those who love my... He didn't say... The word love does not come up. He talks about doing God's will. So a family, Jesus' definition of family is about doing the will of God, which obviously love is, I would say, primary in the will of God. I don't have it, I'm not going anywhere with this. I'm just reflecting on that. But I think of Holden. I mean, Holden's mission statement, I don't know it by heart, and Janet would love to recite it for us now by heart. No, but I assume, is the word love in there?
No.
Is God's will in there? Which is it closer to, if you had to choose those two words, love or God's will?
God's will.
And so this community, this family, by the mission statement, is more gathered around doing God's will than using the word love. I don't know what that means. I'm thinking of church families. I have a church family, and I love those people. But if it's just a big love fest, so are the Kiwanis, so is the country club. We're gathered for a purpose, and that purpose is doing God's will. Which, once again, I'm not excluding love.
Yeah.
So I'll stop talking now.
There's all sorts of families that I deal with because I have all these clients who are facing the death penalty, and they all come out of dysfunctional families, or they wouldn't be in the situation they're in, by and large. But I appeal when I ask their parents and their aunts and uncles and their siblings and their cousins and children. And I ask them to help me, to help me to help the one who's facing the death penalty. And I hear a lot of talk about family from these people. And they say, he's my brother, but he ain't my brother. I'm ashamed of him, I'm angry with him, he's putting this huge burden on our family, he's hurting us, he's asking us to bear our family secrets in court, we don't want to do this. Some families. Other families just say, they just slam the door. They won't even talk to me. We gave up on her long ago. And then some families, as poor and broken as they are, or as troubled as they are, have warm and loving hearts, and they just open themselves up and say, we're gonna do what we can. We're gonna band together. do what we can. I don't know what we learned from that, except, you know, blood relatives aren't always the trick. But, you know, some people, I mean, I had a client who was 53 years old, a white man who was raised on the streets of Chicago, basically, and had a mother who was a hardworking waitress, and they got kicked out of one house after another, apartment after another, because they never had enough money to pay the rent. And he and his sister and his mother were a hearty little band, you know, the three of them. And she died, and then he just had his sister. He had, at age 53, having lived in Chicago his entire life, except for the 2 years he was in the military and became an addict, he had no friends. His sister loved him, and she was willing to do anything. But I asked him, you know, who are your friends? Who can I go talk to? None. So some people don't have a gift for building and making family. And I don't know how that happens. I don't know. I mean, he had a mother who loved him, but starting when he was eight, she had a surgery and then was a diabetic. And in those days, you used those old steel needles that you had to clean with. And she was afraid. She was needle averse. She was afraid of him. So her eight-year-old son, my client, had to shoot her up several times a day with insulin. And he was terrified that he was going to kill his mom constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, and so he had a tender heart, but so who knows? You know, who knows how we become family with one another?
There's a story in this month's Lutheran about a family of siblings who had another sibling who was executed for murdering their parents. And it's really an amazing story about reconciliation and how it was even right up until the last moments, day before the execution, that reconciliation could happen. So, it just makes me think about, is there something about forgiveness and reconciliation that is part of family? And it's not the case for everybody, certainly. But is there that potential?
I was thinking about our church family. We have several people in our choir that are single, never been married. There are various reasons for it. And they get together every Thursday and have breakfast together. And they work, you know, I mean, they're young, and they're all still working. And I thought a lot about, if they hadn't gotten together in our church, that's really their family, and there's no kidding about it, because their parents are all gone. Mm-hmm. They're beyond childbearing age anyway, and they didn't want children anyhow. It's a delight to be with them. They just are so caring of each other. It's beautiful. And I keep thinking, when you reach an age and you might find yourself really isolated, the church is really important.
Church is a hard place to be single.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard place what?
To be single. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but that's the beauty of the one that I go to. They found each other, and they were consistent and kept coming over and over, and so they made their own family there.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, just to add to that, it's just, for some people, though, who are single, it's like, that sounds like a neat group that's grown over the years, but there seem to be so many divisions in churches about here's the family activity, now we're going to have a single activity, mm-hmm. uh-huh. and not enough just blending. I mean, I can appreciate a support group that gets together, but this division of the types of different groups, you know, and then where you fit in that can be awkward.
It's the categorization and, thing again.
Yeah.
Right? Are you the, just or the,
right? On Sunday night, you go to this place because you're that way.
This type meets over here, this type meets over here.
Oh, brutal.
There was thing in the first church I joined after I grew up. They had a group called Pears and Spares.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
But that one's thriving.
Pears and Spares.
Gee, I wonder what's wrong with membership.
So I would like to encourage us to think about how we use family as a buzzword and remember this wide diversity of kinds of families that we all know and affirm and are happy about and that serve everybody's needs well. And we should avoid assuming that the kind of leave it to Cleaver or Beaver or whatever it is, you know, that the two, a man and a woman and 2.5 kids.
Yeah.
I think that's a dangerous concept and it's extremely untrue. I mean, I can't remember, when I taught women's studies, I used to know the statistics, but it's something like 20% of all adult households are that kind of a thing. Then I also want us to think about how the word family values has been stolen from regular people and made into some kind of an ideology that is hostile and dangerous in our present time. So I want us to be able to reclaim the family values we've all been talking about here tonight. And love one another, live in our households of God, and be proud of being family and not allow family values to be stolen as a phrase and made into a weapon to hurt people.
Isn't there a bumper sticker? Can anybody remember it?
Hate is not a family value.
Yes, that's it.
Right. So thank you all for coming. And I know it's late now. It's 20 minutes of 10. And Compline will be at 10 o'clock. And we will be...
Isn't it Gertrude Lundholm?
Yeah.
But it is Compline also.
We're going to use the Compline services and framework.
Oh, very good.
For a memorial service for Gertrude. So it's time to go to bed. Thanks so much. And thank you, panelists.